Welcome to New Zealand Vegan Podcast, episode 151. My name is Elizabeth Collins. I'm your host. Today I have a specific theme that I want to talk about. It's something that I had a discussion about recently with someone in Spanish, but I didn't do a very good job because nowadays I'm not speaking a lot of Spanish, and I can do a podcast in Spanish, but that's much easier than trying to have a conversation with someone who speaks way better Spanish than me. So it didn't go very well, but the thing that we talked about, one of the things that we argued about, I did my best to argue, is sterilization of domesticated animals. And there are people still, apparently a lot of people, who are opposed to this. And the reason given seems to be that it violates their bodily integrity, which it does. And I know that in itself, I called it a noble reason, and I don't mean that I admire. I want to understand. I do understand not wanting to do that, and that is a noble sentiment. Like, I refuse to cut open someone's body without their permission. That's great. However, let's get back into the real world now for a second. I don't want to cut open someone's, or have, you know, pay someone to have their body cut open and sterilized either. But guess what? That is one of the horrific messes that we have to deal with when it comes to domesticated animals. I totally agree with Gary Francione's analysis of the status of, so when we're talking about this, we're talking about pets, okay? The reason I say that is because pets are really the only animals that we have access to every day. We can access those animals. They sort of are in a different category. Yes, there are pet animals, you know, animals like that are of those species that are used for pets, that are used for their meat and are used for their skin and experimented on and all of those things. But when we're talking about pets specifically, it's a specific situation, and we have access to those animals. I can't go to you know, the ones who control the domesticated animals whose bodies we routinely exploit for, you know, consumables, food, blah, blah, blah. We don't have access to those animals. They're not our property. They're not pets. I mean, there are some rescued animals. If you live out in the country, then you can have a pet, you know, cow or sheep or whatever. And then you can choose to sterilize them. But generally speaking, when this issue comes up, at least now, at least until we can, you know, have access to, or until everyone goes vegan, and then we're like, okay, now we have all of the domesticated animals in the world. We want to abolish domestication. These animals don't belong in our world. We made them happen, and we mutated them to be in our world. But generally speaking, we're talking about pets with this subject, at least as it stands today. But the principle applies, as far as I'm concerned, to all domesticated animals. But generally, I'll be focusing on pets. And as I say, unsurprisingly, I agree with Gary Francione's analysis. And one of the best articles, one of the articles I've probably shared the most often with, in my history of sharing Gary Francione's articles, is this article that he wrote in July 31st, 2012, Pets, the Inherent Problems of Domestication. Because he does not want to see any domesticated animals, including pets, and neither do I. I agree with him. And he says very beautifully here, and I'm just going to read it. I read it in my Spanish podcast. Thank goodness there's somebody who translated the article into Spanish, because I didn't have the vocabulary. My Spanish is really bad now. So here we go. This is from the article. Domestic animals are neither a real nor full part of our world or of the non-human world. They exist forever in a netherworld of vulnerability, dependent on us for everything and at risk of harm from an environment that they do not really understand. We have bred them to be compliant and servile, or to have characteristics that are actually harmful to them but are pleasing to us. We may make them happy in one sense, but the relationship can never be, quote, natural, unquote, or, quote, normal, unquote. They do not belong stuck in our world, irrespective of how well we treat them. It's a great article. I'm going to share it again. I will never stop sharing this article. The thing that you really is what I just really spoke, you know, speaks to me, and is that they live in this, they exist forever in a nether world of vulnerability. It is true that they do. And what makes me really mad about this position that people have, where they, well, anyway, the position that was explained to me and the position that I've seen in other places, is that we have no right to sterilize a being against their will. That's true. We have no right to own anybody either. But domestic animals live in a netherworld of vulnerability. They are safest with an adopted family who recognizes their moral personhood, of course, and who treats them, with respect. And this is not to do, when we're talking about the welfare of domesticated animals, this is, don't get it twisted with welfareism. It's not the same thing. There is this thing that we have to focus on when we're talking about the sterilization issue. I hate domestication. I don't like owning my cat, but I do. And I'm not going to lie about it, and I'm not going to pretty it up. And those people who say, oh no, I don't own my cat, she's a family member. Yes, but don't. The reason I don't agree with saying that is because that pretties it up and that belies the truth. The truth of the matter is that you do own them. You do control every aspect of their life. And not only can you have them sterilized, which you should, but you can also have them killed. Or you can have them, you can chop their ears off, or their, you can chop their, you can just, they're your property. That is the reality. So face up to the reality and don't spread this myth and this fantasy. It doesn't help when animal rights advocates are like, oh, I don't own my cat, because they don't want to, they don't like the idea. It offends them. One of the things that really bothers me about this position, I think, is that although I believe it potentially comes from a noble sentiment of not wanting to own an animal, not wanting to be able to control their fertility and all of that, and it is a noble sentiment, but it's also, to me, it's sort of selfish, because to me it's like, I am offended by this. This offends my sensibilities. I want to be able to claim that I have never sterilized an animal against their will, and I don't want to get my hands dirty with this dirty work. Well, you know what? It is dirty work. It's horrible. Everything to do with domestication is horrible. Everything to do with our use of animals is horrible. This is one problem amongst trillions of problems that we as a species have created. And we have to clean it up. And it's our responsibility to do so. And I didn't cause this problem to exist. I was born into this world. I didn't make this happen. But that doesn't, but you know, take away my responsibility now that I'm aware and now that I recognize the moral personhood. And as much as I hate it, and as much as it kills me to deal with domestication, especially the money about it, the money of it, as a person who doesn't have a lot of money, and the horrible decisions you have to make, and people who have really little money have to face agonizing decisions. Agonizing. They would much rather not have to deal with those decisions, I'm sure a lot of them, but they do it because they have a responsibility, and they recognize that these animals are here by the billion because they breed and breed and breed, and we have an obligation to provide them with sanctuary, and that includes, you know, care and safety and all that, and to me includes sterilizing them. And one of the solutions offered by this by the people who don't agree with this is that there are other things that we can do that are better than cutting open their bodies against their will, and that is like isolating them from each other and things. Well, that to me is torturing them, because when you take a social animal and then you especially, I'm going to talk a bit about mice because I have some experience with mice now against my will. Didn't want it, but you know, I had an obligation. It happened in front, you know, I'm not this great rescuer. There are people who are really unbelievable in their selfless selflessness, their rescuing, the things that they do. I am not of that caliber, but it just happened that these mice were put in front of me. I didn't go looking to rescue mice. I could go right now and rescue mice, but I'm not doing it, am I? No. They were in front of me. Jebby was in front of me. Buddha was in front of me, and they rescued. And one of the reasons why I don't do a lot of rescues, because I do have stability now, but I'm still at the mercy of my landlord and at the landlord rules. And my landlord, you know, if my landlord decides to kick me out, there's really very little I can do about it. And then what if I can't find a place that will accept pets? Because that's the reality of the world we live in. And so it's a very scary and stressful situation. But that's not why I want to abolish it. I want to stress that it's not because it stresses me out and because I hate it. It's because it's wrong. It's morally wrong that these animals are in this position. And we need to abolish domestication. And we're not going to abolish domestication if we don't abolish domesticated animals. And what I mean by abolish is like stop breeding them into existence and prevent them from breeding into existence. We have a responsibility to do that in order for this problem to end. And we've bred these animals to breed extensively. Like they breed, they create a huge amount. I mean, a young female cat can get pregnant before she's even a year old. And then she can have a litter of say 8 cats or 5 cats, 3 or 4 of whom might be females who can have babies, and on it goes. And it happens. And we live in cities where it happens. And I don't understand how these people can say that they just want to wash their hands of it and that they just don't want to deal, and that it's not their problem, and that you know, they just, like, there are people who are literally like, it's not my problem, I didn't cause it, and I'm not gonna do anything about it. And then they walk around thinking that they ought to be congratulated because they haven't, you know, taken control of another being and sterilized that being and had that being, given that being surgery. And to me, they are not helping. It's like, you shouldn't even call yourself an abolitionist, in my opinion, if you're not willing to do the dirty work. And it is dirty work that is required to abolish animal use, including domesticated animals, to abolish domestication. And you know, we need to face these difficult decisions and live in the reality of the world that we live in and do the right thing. And for me, the right thing is to do this. If I could just wave a magic wand, and if I could just, oh my God, if I could wave my magic wand, and just, you know, this problem would just go away peacefully, and I would never have to make an agonizing decision like what type of surgery should I do, or like if my cat is sick, or oh my God, I don't have the money to pay for this, or whatever. I mean, I've got insurance for my cat, but it's like $30-something a month. Not everyone can afford that, and that's just one cat. Can you imagine if you had like 5 cats and you had to pay $30-something a month for each of them or whatever? I mean, some people just literally can't afford it, so they do the best they can. And because animals are property, like in my country we have healthcare for humans. If I had a daughter and she got sick, you know, I know that at least in principle or on paper, there's healthcare for her, and it would be paid for. The government would pay for it. The healthcare system would pay for it. Now, it's not a perfect system at all, and there's all kinds of problems with it. But the difference between that and domesticated animals is there isn't that. And, you know, I'm terrified of dying before Jebby. I mean, the thought of losing her, I can't describe how I can't even talk about it, but I'm terrified of dying before her and leaving her in this world. And I'm actually seriously considering getting life insurance for her so that there's money. I get her imported cat food. It's vegan cat food. It costs a fortune, and the New Zealand government is cracking down on it. It is a nightmare to get it. The supplier that I used to buy it from is sadly very, very unreliable. It's very stressful. I can't count on her to get the food, and I don't quite know what's happening with their business, but I gave up and I ended up just having to do it myself. And every time it's a battle, and not everyone can do that. So for my cat, if I passed away and my mum couldn't adopt her because she has a cat and Jebby just can't live with other cats, and then maybe my brother would adopt her, I'm not guaranteeing he would, but maybe he would. But would he be able to afford this cat food, or would he do it? You know, pay these hundreds of dollars to get this vegan cat food in to New Zealand, and then her health would be at risk because she has very compromised immunity because she was raised by me. She was born, she was literally She had no mother's milk. She was covered in birth fluid. She hadn't even been licked. Her mother hadn't even licked her. So we don't know what happened. There's a myriad of possibilities, lots of possibilities. But the obvious reality is that Gebbi was never was with her mother. I mean, right after birth, that was it. She was separated from her mother. She wasn't even cleaned. She wasn't even, the birth fluid wasn't even licked off her. She definitely didn't suckle. And she was hand-raised from a few hours old and by me, very inept, on kitten, formula. There was no surrogate mother. If we'd have found a surrogate female cat who was nursing to take her in, that would have been the best case scenario, but it wasn't. So she never got those antibodies from her mother. She never got the colostrum, I think it's called, from the milk. And also she was very, very, very ill from the formula. And I went through hell with her when she was young. She was very ill. She was alternatively constipated and dehydrated. I could never get it right. And she has proven compromised immunity. I've had experiences with her. I have to be very careful with her that she doesn't get physically hurt, or that she doesn't catch, that she doesn't get an infection and things, because her immune system's compromised. And she's thrived on this food. She's been eating this food since she's like a year old. And I am not going to switch her diet. It's very dangerous to switch cats' diets. I saw it with Buddha when I moved her from New York. Anyway, I'm raving, but these are the things I'm scared of. And not only that, like if nobody could take her in and she was put in a what's called a shelter, for want of a better name, she could literally be put to death if she's not adopted. She could be put to death. And that's not, children go through horrible things, but there's not this risk of them being gassed if they can't find an adopted home for them. So it's just this insane attitude that I don't understand. Well, like, I'm trying to understand it. Like, I do understand the sentiment of not wanting to. But to me, like I said, the only reason I say it's selfish is because to me it's like, want to wash your hands of the whole thing. And you don't want to deal with it. And you don't want to help us. So you should. I don't think anyone who doesn't want to help us abolish animal domestication and animal use, which includes having to sterilize animals, I don't think you should call yourself an abolitionist. That's my position, because you're not willing to do the necessary things to abolish it. So you call yourself an abolitionist, but then you remove yourself from this responsibility and this work, and you leave it all to us, and it puts more of a burden on us. So that's my position, and I'm very vehement about it, as you can see, as I am about a lot of things. It's just my nature. So there is peace. There are still people out there who feel this way. And apparently there's lots of them, especially in South America, apparently, from what I've been told. I don't know what. In South America, there's a lot of animals living in the streets, more than there are in New Zealand. They don't really have the... New Zealand's a very privileged country, but there are cats. But I saw in New York there were so many animals living in the streets, and I don't even want to tell you some of the, like, I have so much guilt from not having a place, not having stability, not being able to take in anyone, because I didn't have any autonomy. I was living in someone's couch, and it was their house and their rules. That's happened to me a couple of times. So it's a very vulnerable position to be in, to be a domesticated animal, and they shouldn't exist, and we should sterilize them and do the best we can. And if I could wave a magic wand and make them sterile, I would. If I could give them a pill that didn't have to do any surgery, I would. But, I don't. I don't have those solutions. The only solutions I have is surgery. And I'm now going to tell you about my mice, because I think this is an important story. A lot of people might not know about the mice, but this was what, one of the reasons I'm so vehement about it is because I've personally seen, we all have. I mean, anyone who's seen a stray cat starving, ill, I have not seen a lot of happy, healthy stray cats. I don't know about you. Or dogs. There's not a huge amount of dogs that you see. They're easier to catch, I think, or they're more visible, or they're more, like, stray cats can be just ignored, like, depending on it, if they wreak havoc. Stray dogs might be a bit more, I don't know, but for some reason I think they're targeted more, whereas cats are sort of, it depends, but, they just are kind of like, I think that they're just less, they're just more likely to just be left. Like, oh yeah, they just don't get. But if there's a stray dog, people are worried about being attacked, or, you know, so people are more likely to be like, oh, get that stray dog, it's dangerous, blah blah blah, because that's the attitude that people have. Whereas for stray cats, they usually just don't care about them, and they sort of live in the shadows. And, you know, I mean, stray dogs do their best to live in the shadows, but anyway, except for when they do beg for help. And oh my gosh, so I happened to be at my job where I was working with social workers. I was an admin person, and there was a, they ended up with a, three cages full of mice that they had gotten from one of their charges who had been adopted. You know, this was a person with mental health issues and was buying lots of animals and was not able, they weren't able to find, she kept getting booted out of her residences, and she was under the care of the government because she'd been in foster care. And so then they would, you know, she would lose her living situation, and it was because she would just go and buy all these animals, and she was also very abusive to those animals as well, and she would just let them breed and breed, because you can go and buy rats, lizards, birds, mice, and they're not sterilized, and they can just breed and breed, and they're your property, and if you wring their necks and throw them in the garbage, it doesn't matter to the pet store, and you will just go and buy more, and they will just sell her them. So they basically removed, they took her property off her, which is, you know, it was her property, this animal stock of rats and of mice or whatever they were, but they were removed from her because they weren't able to get her a place to live, and they ended up at the office, literally at the office, walking past my desk. My colleague was carrying two cages. Now this is an office, and I'm like, what are you doing with cages? And oh my god, I can see some mice. Like, I was like, what the hell? Oh, these are mice. And they told me a little bit, and they said, we're going to take them to the SPCA. And I was like, no, you're not. They're going to be killed. I'm going to take them. And there was a few coincidences that helped me to be able to do this. Number one, I had been living in New Zealand. This is 2015. So I moved to New Zealand in March of 2008. So I'd been in New Zealand for a good 7 years, and I had been earning very little money, and I'd been a student, and I'd been broke. And I happened to have backlog of taxes, which I never filed, and I was able to get money back for taxes, because when you're really, really, really poor, you actually get a little bit of tax money back at the end of the year, which I sort of didn't know about and forgot about. And what happened is a few weeks, even like really not that long before this my situation happened, I was at my job and I took my car in, and my car needed new brakes, and I had zero savings, literally nothing, which is not unusual for me. And it was going to cost $600 something. And I was panicking because I needed new brakes in order to get a warrant of fitness for my car. And I did not have the money. $600 was an impossible sum for me. And then I can't remember who it was, but someone was like, have you, you know, what about your tax returns? Have you done your tax returns? And I was like, no, I haven't done any since I've been back. And they're like, do them. So I did my tax returns going back to 2008. And I literally, I'm not kidding you, I got like $2,500 or $3,000. It was unbelievable. I was like, oh my gosh, this is the best. So I got all my tax money. I paid for my car's brakes. And I was like, I have savings. Wow. And I had a little safety net. And I was like, whew. And then not that much longer later, I get to work and there's these mice, and I'm like, I'm taking these mice. That was the first coincidence, was having that money put aside. The second coincidence was that there was a vet close to me, reasonably close to me, that was an exotic animal vet, because when you're talking about rats, mice, birds and lizards and anything like that, even rabbits, although I think some regular vets see rabbits, they're called exotic animals, and the vets are specialists, and it's way more expensive for their care. But there just happened to be an exotic vet down close to where I lived, and I had the best boss in the world who let me take heaps of time off for vet visits. Because think about it, so when I got the mice home, so I said, give me those mice, and then I didn't know what the heck I was doing. I mean, I had nothing, and I have one room. I do have a kitchen down the side, but it's not like a whole nother room. It's not like a kitchen like what you think. You two people can't walk sideways in my kitchen. It's there's nowhere to put anything except for like dishes and stuff. And then I've got my one single room. So plus I had a cat, okay, who was, you know, very dangerous for these mice. So I had to put them on top of the wardrobe, stacked on top of each other. I had no containers. I had the two cages. They were all in there together. It turned out there was 18 of them. Plus there was another cage. One of the ladies said, I have another cage at home with two mice living in it. I think they're a couple. And I was like, oh my God, they're probably pregnant. So I can't even describe to you how frantic and insane the next few weeks and months were with these, trying to deal with the situation. I can't even describe to you, because there's a lot of factors at play here. Number one, mice become fertile at a very young age. Number two, they can have a lot of babies at once. Number three, all of these mice, like some of them were the children of some of the mice. So this is already, we're at a second generation. Number three, it's very hard to sex mice when they're very young. Even an experienced vet can't sex them when they're really young. The genitalia, it's not formed enough, and they can't tell you whether it's a boy or a girl. So you don't know, but they could still be fertile and getting pregnant, and you still can't quite, you still don't quite know who's a boy and who's a girl. Number three, male mice can't live together because they will fight to the death. Literally, I am not kidding. This is a fact. They will fight to the death. Female mice can live together, and obviously they won't get each other pregnant, so there's one option. But I had, and there was a total of 18 of these mice. 18. Now, one of them was clearly pregnant, already pregnant. So one of my first priorities was getting her an abortion. Okay. The other mouse turned out was pregnant as well, and I got them both abortions. And if you don't agree with that, well, too bad. I agree with abortion. So I got them aborted and sterilized. One of them had 8 fetuses and the other had 11. So that's 19 more at once. Now, dealing with 18 mice, I cannot even describe to you what that was like for me, getting them all veterinary care, getting them sterilized. That $2,500 lasted a couple of months, if that. And then I fundraised. Now that's all for the initial vet bills. That's for the surgeries. Cause I had to separate them all into individual cages because I didn't know who was a boy or a girl, and I was terrified of them getting pregnant. So the adults who were pregnant, they became sterilized. And then they could go back. So one of them was a couple, like a little married couple. So she got sterilized, and then I got him sterilized because I needed help. I could not look after 18 mice. The time of keeping them properly, keeping their cages clean and fresh water and all of the things that they need and stimulated and vet care and all that was beyond me. But I did all the initial stuff. And to be honest, I actually people donated money, and I accepted the money. I have never been an animal rescuer. I have never accepted donations from anyone for anything, but I did for these mice because I ran through that $2,500 very quickly because they're very expensive for the surgery. And in fact, the vet was incredible. Not one single mouse died, and he performed desexing surgery. I think it was only two of them that I didn't get desexed because they ended up being just two girls living together, and the man was never gonna. I trusted him. He was vegan, and he was pretty onto it in that regard, in terms of he wasn't gonna let them breed or give them away, and he looked after them right till the end. Actually, in fact, it was very sad. One of them was very sick, and he didn't have the heart to take her to the vet. She had to be euthanized. Her tumors were so big, and he paid for it, but I actually had to do it because it broke his heart to do it. And her other sister had already passed away not long before. They get very, very sick. Domestic mice, and they can't live in the wild. You can't let domestic mice out. They just don't have it. Like Gary said, they don't belong in that world. It would have just been like throwing them to a snake or something. They would have just died. So I had to look after them. I couldn't take them to the SPCA. They would have immediately been killed, especially being pregnant, especially not being sterilized, especially being mice. Nobody cares about mice. You can buy them for $8. One mouse. That's how much they cost at the pet store. And they're not sterilized. Can you imagine how many? I think I've done a podcast about this before, but this is to do with the people who are like, don't sterilize animals. It's a violation of their rights. And I'm like, oh yeah, great. Thanks a lot. So, I did that, so I prevented 19 more mice being born in a very short space of time, especially one of them. She wasn't going to be too long before she was going to have those babies. And then the rest of them I had to keep separate, which it makes them very lonely. They are very social animals. It's extremely stressful to them, and they will die of loneliness and be very suffering. And it's really literally torturing them. Like humans, the same thing, putting them in solitude. And these animals are living in cages. And even though they're domesticated mice, it's still not natural for them to live in a tiny little cage, living in their own feces. And you know what used to really bother me is people are like, oh my God, they stink. I don't want mice, they stink. And I'm like, you know why they stink? Because you're not cleaning their cage. Clean the damn cage if the cage stinks. How would you like to live in a room that big with that was where your toilet was and everything? Mice are clean animals, very clean animals. It's not their fault they're in that situation. That's what stinks. Humans not cleaning the cages properly and humans putting them in the situation. Of course it's going to stink. You would stink too if you lived in a cage with no toilet. And oh my God, sorry, I'm getting angry. This makes me angry. And so then it took ages and ages for them to grow up enough. There were two absolute newborns who were still actually nursing. She was pregnant, but she was also nursing her two. So she was... that can literally happen as well. Like they can literally get pregnant almost immediately from giving birth. So she was nursing two babies and pregnant, and the amazing vet gave her the abortion of her eight fetuses. She had eight and was able to still preserve, like she was able to continue to nurse those other two. But I had to be very careful because I was like panicking because those other two, what if they were a boy and a girl, because they will breed with each other and it's a very short window of time. But luckily they were two little girls, Popcorn and Snowflake, and they stayed together for life. But poor Snowflake died first and Popcorn was devastated and it was just heartbreaking. But so if I hadn't, like, imagine if I was one of those people who was like, oh no, it's offensive to me to sterilize these animals. And I'm saying that I don't mean to antagonize, but that to me is really what it is. But okay, I could use a different phrase. Maybe not it's offensive to me, but oh no, I really don't want to do this to them. What am I going to do? Well, you know, you had two options. You could separate them all, except for the girls, one, and then wait for the girls to be six and then let the girls live together. But what are you going to do with the guys? Let me tell you, they cannot live together unless they've been sterilized, because they will fight to the death. Look it up. I'm not making this up. They can't live with the girls if the girls haven't been sterilized, because they will breed and breed and breed. So what are you going to do with the boys? Let me ask you, what are you going to do with the boys? Why are there no roosters in these backyard hen farms? Do you want to know why? Because they fight to the death. Okay, that's why. So they get put in the pot, they get eaten. So the males, you know, when you sterilize them, yes, it violates their bodily integrity, and yes, you're doing it without their permission, but guess what? Then they can live together in companionship, and they aren't being tortured with isolation and solitary confinement, and they can survive the surgery, and then they can live, you know, as best a life as you can give them in this horrible situation, and you can fulfill your responsibility in the best way you can. We are limited in our choices here. So I did that. So I had to separate them all. I can't even describe to you how chaotic this is. I had no containers. I had to quickly buy all this stuff. Some of them were so tiny that they would escape the cages, because the traditional mouse cages was too small. They were so little. They were so young. And that's why they couldn't be six, that they would escape. And I can't tell you, they escaped in the car on the way back to the vet once. And it was the scariest thing in my life trying to find them. And I was like, how did they get out? What did I do wrong? And I realized that they were squeezing through the bars of the cage. So then I had to put them, this is not ideal. When I first took them home, I had them in all these different containers because I knew that I was at risk of breeding. So luckily nobody else got pregnant. I managed to separate them all before anyone else got pregnant because they were all so young. And then they were old enough to be sexed. So I took them to the vet one by one. We've managed, as they got older, we're like, okay, this is a boy. He can have surgery and then he can live. You know, I just was like, sterilize them all. And then I was adopting them out sterilized because I didn't trust people, except for very couple of people, I think. But mostly I wouldn't like adopt out unsterilized mice to people. I don't trust people to be responsible with that. So I wasn't about to adopt out anyone who wasn't sterilized to a stranger. And I couldn't only adopt them out to vegan people because I was desperate. I couldn't be exclusive in that way. I didn't have the resources to continue to look after all 18 of them. I ended up looking after eight. And believe you when I tell you that that was a lot of work. And it wasn't ideal, you know, for them, for the mice. They were, and I had to keep them up high. and because otherwise Jebby, you know. And I did not get sleep for the entire 2 or 3 years that they were with me because they were so noisy. They're nocturnal. That's when they come out and play on their little wheels, and you have to give them stuff to do or they'll go crazy. So you have to give them things to chew on because otherwise they'll chew on the metal of the cages, which is not good for them. You have to give them things to run around in because they're in these cages where they don't have room. So you have to give them wheels and things, and they're so noisy. So imagine 8 mice in about 4 cages. I think they had them paired off, making all this noise every night right next to my bed in my same room because I didn't have another room to put them in. I mean, this is all about me complaining. I did it because it was the right thing to do, it's not about me, but that is just to let you know it's not, you know. It was not an easy time for me either, but it certainly wasn't an easy time for them. But yeah, so I don't know. And so it's like, what, it you know, this is just one example of why sterilization is just a necessary evil. You know, I hate to use that term, but and I have no regrets about getting them sterilized. It meant that they could live together. It meant that they could live longer and not fight to the death or be isolated and be tortured from solitary confinement and be literally tortured. And they had companionship, and it was very challenging because there was a lot of illness because they, you know, domesticated mice have lots of diseases and things like tumors and stuff. And then what do? One of them dies, and now you have a single mouse, and you cannot leave a single mouse alone in a cage. That is torture. So unless you can spend all day with them and they can be your companion. But I couldn't do that. I work full time. So I had to then try to, to introduce them to another family. And that was fraught. There was fighting and territory. It was very fraught. Every time I had to put mice together as adults, it was always dangerous. I was always terrified. And injuries, extensive injuries can happen. I have a mouse who I adopted out who was called Mr. Two Toes because he had toes bitten off by another mouse, literally bit his toes off. I had little AB who was covered in horrific abscesses as a baby because he was a male and he was at an age where they were starting to fight. The males were starting to fight. They were at that type of age. It happens very quickly that they start to fight and try to kill each other. And he was obviously not very strong and not very, he was a weaker one. And he was really badly injured. And it's really sad because I had these 18 mice and I was trying to give them all names, especially when I started to try to adopt them. I tried to give them cute names, but this is kind of gross, but I just didn't have enough names. So AB was AB because abscess, you know, AB for abscess. He was the abscess boy. So I'm like, okay, abscess boy, AB, because he was covered with abscesses. And BB stands for bleeding boy, because when he had his surgery, he bled a bit more. And the vet was like, I had to keep him in for a bit more observation because he bled a bit more than the other boys. And we were a bit worried about him because the surgery was a risk. Credit to the vet. None of them died during surgery. He sterilized. I didn't get them all sterilized. Like I said, there was a couple of girls who I didn't have to. And because they went to good trusting homes. I sterilized all the boys though, so they wouldn't be aggressive and kill each other and kill their mates. But, well, they probably wouldn't kill their mates. I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. But just because I didn't trust people out adopting them out to, not to bring in another female who hadn't been sterilized. Who, let me ask you, in this day and age where people complain and moan and groan about paying vet bills for their dog who they raised since a puppy who's a member of their family, the first thing that people do when they talk about their animals being sick is like, oh my God, the money. Oh my God, the money. Do they do that with their children? Do you say that, oh, the doctor's visits, all the bills? Well, a lot of times it's covered by the government, number one, but also it's just like not, but with animals it's like, oh, how much is this gonna cost, you know? But anyway, who do you know, like your average person, your average non-vegan, therefore a person who's not, doesn't recognize the moral personhood of animals and doesn't value their rights, who is gonna pay, you know, $1,000 in vet bills, because that's how much one mouse can cost you, for an animal who is gonna live for 2 years and who costs $8? You know, I mean, domestication needs to end, and the only way we're going to do it is one of the ways that we have to sterilize domesticated animals. And there's, you know, lucky for us, there are vets at the moment, because we live in a world in which veterinary medicine is used because we have domesticated animals. But I want to live in a world where there's no domesticated animals at all, not living in the streets, not, you know, living in the gutter, and not living in anyone's home either. And then we won't have vets, and that's, you know, okay, let's find something else to do. But in the meantime, we actually need vets to help us in domestication. We need people who know how to sterilize animals anyway. And if the world were to go vegan tomorrow, which it won't, but let's say it were, we'd have to do our best. We have to start sterilizing, you know, doing our best to stop these other animals from breeding as well. And because there's billions of them. And the farmers right now are the ones in charge of that. And they are breeding them deliberately. They do control their reproduction because that's the business. So they want them to produce more, but they control when it happens. But we would have to, if we all went vegan and we wanted to end domestication, we would have to take on the responsibility of stopping domesticated animals from existing. And I'm sorry, but there's just, if anyone has a better way apart from like separating them all and putting them all in isolated, I don't know how you would do that with the billions of animals that we have, then by all means, you know, I'd love a better solution, but right now I don't see one. And I, as much as I hate it, I'm willing to do the dirty work and make the difficult decisions, whether I like it or not, because I have a moral responsibility. I have a moral responsibility to be vegan. I have a moral responsibility to educate other people about veganism to the best of my crappy ability. I'm not very good at it. And I have a moral obligation to adopt it with, you know, if I can, and provide sanctuary for any number of domesticated animals, whether it's one, if that's all I can do, or two, or whatever the case may be, and do the right thing by that animal, and recognizing that it's not right that I have complete power over their body and they have no autonomy, but just accepting that this is my responsibility and I have to do what's necessary because I'm an abolitionist. So that's the end of my rant for today. I'm glad I got that off my chest. It's been bothering me ever since it came up. I forgot all about this subgroup of anti-sterilizers. And if you're listening and you're one of them, I don't mean to offend you. That's not my purpose. I'm not here to antagonize, but I am very, very, very upset by your position. And it's I'm very, very opposed to your position, obviously. And I've given my reasons why, and they may not be adequate reasons for you, but they are my reasons. And I really, really wish that you would not shirk your responsibility. I shouldn't say that, but anyway, so that's the end of that. Any other news? Well, it's raining a lot. It's the middle of winter. The last time we did the stall was May, so that's like 2 months ago. So just like my podcast, The Street Stall is this languishing thing. It's always going to be there. My life has improved in terms of my time and my energy since I passed my exam, which was all the way in February, but now it's winter. And I'm hoping that I can, I don't know how often I'm going to I don't know if I'll ever get back to podcasting once a week or once a fortnight like I used to, but I definitely want to do The Street Stall in the summer at least, sort of once a month. And I'm sure I'll still do my podcast. I need my podcast. I need it. But it's I'm just not as active on it, sorry, as I used to be. I've been invited back to be a podcast on Always for Animal Rights. with Carolyn, and so next week we're going to do it again. She's invited me back, which is very, very nice of her. I think her podcast, from what I can tell, is very much an interview podcast. It's just interviewing all different people. I used to interview people. I used to look for people to interview, but I've kind of stopped doing it because I'm very, obviously I don't want anyone on my podcast who's not an abolitionist approach vegan, because unless I'm there to argue with them, I don't want to promote any work that is not in align. I'm allowed to do that. I know the work's out there, and people might say, well, that's censorship. Well, it's not. It's my podcast. I'm not trying to stop these people from publishing their work. I just don't want to promote it. And I've also had many experiences where I've had people on my podcast, and a couple of years later, they completely changed, and I was like, but at the time they didn't, you know. Anyway, I just kind of gave up. I'm sort of being a bit out of touch as well. Like, I don't really know anyone who I can invite onto my podcast now, to be honest. I actually don't have any contacts, except for Jeff will come. He definitely will come on, because he's my street stall buddy. So we will, maybe next episode, maybe it'll be a me and Jeff episode talking about the street stall. It'll be good. We had a great street stall last time. Just want to briefly talk about that. Look, we did the street stall, we set it up, and it was such a quiet day. Not one, like, you know, we were standing there for ages and ages and nobody came over. But finally someone did, and that person was worth the whole day. And after that, a bunch of people did come. But even if just that one person came, it's a lot of effort to reach just one person. But honestly, I can't tell you how much I value. Everyone's like, there's these people who are like, you want to reach thousands of people all at once. And, you know, that's why they're like, we got to do these massive, you know, YouTube stuff and stuff. But there are some people like me who just don't attract a lot of views. I'm just not really a blogger or a, you know, I just am not, that's not my thing. I'm not good at it. I don't have a trillion followers. And I'm also not, I also would like to say that a lot of the people who do have a lot of followers tend to be complete sellouts. You know, they sell out to welfareism almost immediately, because that's how you get lots and lots of followers. Or they start to become corrupt and take money, because that's another way that you get lots and lots of followers. And so what I'm trying to say is, like, to me personally, it's worth it. Number one, it's just good to have the word out there and just to have your stall out there visible, because like, you are making a statement that way. But also, to me, getting up, putting everything together, driving down there, spending the whole day standing, you know, not taking care of other business, is totally worth it, even for one person that you can make a connection with, because that one person becomes the person in their circle who... And it's not like, oh, one person at a time we change the world, but in a way it is. Do you know what I mean? It's an idea. You have to share the idea. So what I'm trying to say is, this one person came over and made the whole day worth it. Even if nobody else had come over, which people did, that one person would have been worth it, because we had a connection, because their position was, they said, and of course I can't follow them home and say that this actually stuck, but you know when you've kind of, you can see it in someone's eyes, you know, when you recognize it, because you sort of see yourself in them when the right thing was said to you, or when it clicked for you, or, you know, like for me, it was like reading Gary Francione's work very early on after becoming a vegan, and hearing the interview with Eric Marcus. Also, that was very profound for me, the debate, with Eric Marcus. That was a life-changing debate for me. And it just 100%, I was like, I'm an abolitionist, and I agree with Gary Francione, and I disagree with Eric Marcus. I mean, and it was just 2 hours later, or even halfway through, even after hearing Gary's opening talk, just listen to that. That is one of the best summaries, in my opinion, of the abolitionist approach, is in that first part of the debate with Eric Marcus, when Eric Marcus is like, okay, you go ahead and introduce yourself. It's, even just that is amazing. So I saw this girl, and she came over, and she was like, oh yeah, I really, you know, agree with you. And, you know, we have so many people saying, I agree with you. And then it's like, are you vegan? No. And it's like, okay, let's unpack that. But, she's like, I agree. And she's like, I'm vegan, but, you know, if people offer me something, then it's already, like, so many people do this. This is quite a common thing, by the way, that you might encounter. So you better figure out how to deal with it. Because you're going to get it a lot if you're out there talking to people. They'll say, look, I'm vegan and I don't buy any animal products and I don't, you know, I don't do it. But if people offer me something, I'll eat it because it's already been made and it's, and I didn't pay for it. And it's a waste of resources. And, you know, I'm not actually contributing directly because I didn't go out and buy it. And, you know, that's not the point. The point is that what do you represent? Especially if you tell someone you're vegan. So I just gave her my opinion, you know, my point of view, my response, which for anyone listening who's interested in what my response to that question is to that situation, is I'm like, look, it's not only about your economic contribution. It's about what idea you are representing and spreading and demonstrating to people, especially if you call yourself a vegan. If you call yourself a vegan, that's why welfareism and people who wear leather and people who eat honey and people who, you know, call themselves a vegan who aren't, they're so infuriating to me, because it's just this precious, precious, very, very important idea and thing. And so I said, you know, when you are saying that you're a vegan and then you do something non-vegan, even though you in a practical sense didn't actually financially contribute at that moment, you didn't buy the product, that's not the point. The point is, what are you representing? And I say to them, please, you know, you're not helping us, you're hurting us. You're here saying you support us and you agree with what we're doing, but you're actually countering us. You're actually undermining us when you do that every single time you do that, because you're not living up to what you represent. And so you're teaching them. You're a teacher. You're an educator, I told her. And what you're teaching them is that veganism is not, it's wishy-washy and it's kind of arbitrary. And you can call yourself a vegan, but you don't actually have to do it. And so that demeans animals, that lessens them morally, and it adulterates, you know what I mean? And I didn't use those necessarily, those words or whatever, but that's the concept. And I'm kind of like trying to plead with them to say, you know, look, stand by what you believe in and demonstrate what you believe in and be it every second of the day. And you not only will gain more respect from your friends and family, and they won't shun you. I mean, you know, if they do, it's rare for someone to completely shun you, as long as you just say, look, I'm not going to eat that, and you explain why, and you give them good reasons. They're such good reasons. Veganism is so logical. It's so well thought out, especially the abolitionist approach. If you understand it and you know how to approach it and how to apply it, it's just irrefutable. And it makes so much sense. And so when you represent that, and then you turn around and undermine yourself and instantly contradict yourself, then you've just taken 20 steps backwards, and you've actually hurt everything, and you've actually presented yourself as someone who doesn't actually really stand by, or you're not actually what you say you are. And I'm like, you can do it, and you can be this educator, and I don't know, we just had a little conversation, but she, you know, she really, really was like, yeah, I hear you. Like, and I know, and I'm pretty sure she did. And my thought is that she's not going to do that anymore. And to me, that's major. You know, she's now going to go out and be a solid, person. And everyone, and a lot of the welfareists are like, lead by example, which is ironic, because the example that they're giving is like, animals are property and it doesn't matter. But a lot of people's like, don't, you know, you can't be unequivocal and you have to compromise, but just lead by example. So like, they'll be like, I don't argue with people, but I just bring vegan cake or whatever. But if you really want to do that, then you have to lead by example. And leading by example is not taking a piece of cheese pizza because your friend made it. You know, leading by example is saying, I'm vegan. Not only do I not buy cheese and, you know, animal, cheese, I will not do it, because that reinforces the idea that animals don't matter. It does, whether you like it or not. You would not do the same if it was a human product in question. So it's just speciesism. It's reinforcing speciesism. It's behaving speciesist, which is the opposite of veganism. So that's why it's so important. That's why it's just so important. All this dumpster diving stuff and all this like wearing recycled leather stuff, it's actually harmful. Okay, you are hurting the animals. You are not. You are being speciesist. So anyway, I just feel like I'm so glad I was there that day. I'm so glad I was there that day. And that's what I mean. So I'm doing what I can do, but every time I do it, as much as I can, as best to my ability, and I'm pretty sure I succeed in it, or I really hope I do, I'm unequivocal, because that is the right thing to do, is to be uncompromising, to be radical. I am very radical when it comes to animal rights. I'm radical when it comes to human rights too. I'm a fanatic, or whatever, fundamentalist, not fanatic. If you listen to the debate with Eric Marcus, it's a great, that debate will never, ever go out of, necessity of listening, because it's very pervasive. So it was worth it to me to be there that day. And, I've never had a day where we didn't have that. So I've had days that were slow, where I was like, oh, is this going to be the day where I literally have not one single person come to my stall and I stand here the entire day and not one single conversation? And then I can still say, well, at least I was there and I had the word vegan and I had, we have moral personhood and things like that on our table and stop violence. So, it's still a billboard, if you will, but the conversations are key. The conversations are really where it's at. The two-way interaction, not the one-way. It has to be two-way. So if I was there and no one came up, that was just one way. And I'm not really a fan of one way. What I mean by one way is like standing there quietly holding a sign. It's fine and everything, but it's really one way. What the value that I believe in education is two-way, which means you have to listen to people and engage with them. So if no one had come to our stall and it was just us standing there and people driving past, and you can read Stop Violence, Go Vegan from the road, from the cars. So that's just one way. So I much prefer the two way. So I've never had a day where, touch wood, let's hope it never happens, where it's only ever been a one way thing. And I would still not regret it. It's better than sitting at home watching Netflix. But and even if it's just one person that I have the two-way interaction with, then it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's worth the effort to get out there. Do what works for you, as long as it's unequivocal and as long as it's abolitionist approach. I support it, as long as it's non-violent, creative, non-violent, unequivocal vegan education. You can do it. And if it is one way, it's better than nothing, but it's also way better than two-way welfareism. So if the choice is between two-way welfareism or one-way unequivocal veganism, then do the one way. By one way, you know what I'm saying. I've done a podcast on it, about it before. It's like no interaction except for you're just standing at them. I don't agree with videos, violent videos of animal use. I've talked about that before. So yeah, this tree stall, anyway, it's just one of those things. It's pouring right now. It was pouring today. I would never do it on a Sunday anyway. And yesterday was a pretty good afternoon. We could have done it yesterday, but it was raining all morning. So usually if it's raining in the morning, the weather's so changeable, it's we don't end up doing it. Jeff has to come a long way. I'm quite close, but he has to come quite a long way. So really, we need that sort of really good weather, which we don't get a lot of in the winter. But anyway, don't worry. Anyway, that's the end of that for now. But we'll do another stall, and then I'll have him on, and we can talk about it, because it's always fun to rehash the stall experiences for people. So anyway, thanks for listening to my podcast, and I'll be back. Bye.